This is Eleanor Swent continuing an interview with Frank Joklik in Salt Lake City, Utah on January 21st, 1994. Okay, so.
Yeah, in the realm of cost reduction without capital investment, one other development I should mention is this, that on the west side of the Utah copper ore body is high-grade copper mineralization in some limestone formations that are intersected by the monzonite stock that contains much of the Utah copper mineralization. Now, these limestone formations are at a depth of 3,000 feet in the area of the Bingham Canyon drainage. They continue up dip towards the west into what is known as the Car Fork area. Now, the boundary between Kennicott's property and the adjoining property that had been held for decades by Anaconda runs, or ran along the western margin of the pit. And inhibited stripping in that area to expose the western deep ore, still accessible by open pit, in the mining operation. So for many years, a discussion had been going on, or a negotiation between Kennicott and Anaconda, to give Kennicott stripping rights on Anaconda ground in the Car Fork area, so that this ore on the western side of the pit could be accessed for mining.
Was Anaconda actually mining there, or just holding?
No, they weren't mining.
But
there.
They held the property.
And then Kennicott never could agree to the price being asked by Anaconda, which, even going back 20 years, was of the order of $30 to $50 million. Then Anaconda started up or developed the Car Fork operation, which was intended to access these limestone formations from the Tooele Valley side, on the western side of the Oka Range. The limestone formations were there all right, but their grade was much lower than at depth in the Bingham Canyon area, about 1.5% copper versus 3 to 4%. They defined a quote-unquote ore body and planned a mining method for it. They put down something like 20 drill holes from the surface and then went to shaft sinking and had a mine plan and built a concentrator in Carrefour Canyon. Again, this is accessed from the Tooele side. And this came on stream, I guess must have been late in the 70s, and operated for only about 8 months, because the mining method was clearly poorly chosen, because they got uncontrollable dilution from the adjoining formations, and the concentrator operated at less than design capacity. If I recall, design capacity was about 10,000 tons a day. Never attained anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the mill heads were just a fraction of what they had anticipated, and they had to shut it down and take a write-off of about $200 million.
Mm.
The concentrators were... Well, the concentrator was subsequently dismantled. The next time I saw it was reassembled at Octeti in Papua New Guinea.
Oh.
Part of it, at least. And the other part of it, I think, went down to Quintana in Arizona.
Oh.
Anyway, Anaconda, after that experience, and their general withdrawal from the mining industry after the ARCO acquisition of Anaconda, were much more disposed to make a reasonable deal with Kennecott concerning this ground on the west side of Bingham Canyon. And I negotiated an agreement with, I think Ralph Cox was in charge for Anaconda at that time, whereby we bought all their holdings, with some exceptions, for $5 million, which gave us access to another 200 or 300 million tons of good grade ore in the western side of the Bingham Canyon ore body. And that has played a substantial role in production and cost reduction since that agreement was made, I believe, in 1983. When I say with some exceptions, there were some slag and concentrate deposits, slag and tailings and waste rock deposits resulting from the historic operations that we clearly did not want to acquire title to, both in the Tooele Valley and along the eastern front of the Oka Range in the Bingham Canyon channel and Lark areas, so we excised those from the transfer of property. A few comments on the atmosphere in which the very substantial manpower reductions took place between 1980 and 1983-84. I quickly learned that to agree with a reduction in force of people whom you didn't know personally caused general concern about the future sources of employment of of such people, but also that if you knew these people personally, you had to go from considering a group of people to considering individuals, and that was very tough. The attitude of the hourly people that we had to let go was surprisingly understanding. I'm not saying for a minute that they weren't full of anger and disappointment and resentment. They were. But I was surprised, especially during the later town meetings that we had at our operations, how well informed they were about the economics of our business, and how much they believed what we told them and what they saw. And I think we have to attribute that to the very strenuous efforts we made to communicate with the employees at all levels. Here in Salt Lake, the relatively supportive attitude of the media and of the politicians here, I think was colored by everybody's fear, including mine, that we were going to lose the operation entirely. Because the copper industry in the United States had been downsized by the time it came to closing down Bingham Canyon from a production rate of 1.7 million tons of copper in newly mined ore each year to less than a million tons. So there were plenty of other shutdown operations. And especially with the new ownership of the oil company and the clear signals we got pretty early on that copper and mining would never be part of their core businesses, the gulf in philosophy that existed between ours and the oil company management, there was strong reason to fear that our operations, particularly Bingham Canyon, would be shut down for the long term, for a long term anyway, and that capital to refurbish the operations and bring them back to a reasonable level of production just mightn't be available anywhere. Copper was such a dirty word, and the demise of the mining industry, which was highlighted on the cover of, I forget the publication, whether it was Newsweek or whatever, was something that the public had bought into, by and large. It was extremely difficult to say goodbye to some of the people that one knew well in headquarters, especially many of them very well qualified. You see, these reductions in force were on a scale that you weren't just letting the poor performers go. I mean, there were functions being eliminated where excellent people who were attached to us had to take their leave. And to see good people go out into the unknown and find employment elsewhere was very, very difficult. Where did the bulk of the people find employment elsewhere? Well, amongst the salaried people, many left the mining industry and were permanently lost, both engineering, financial people, human resource people. But they had the tradition and many of them the means to exercise some mobility and move somewhere else as demanded. This is generally not the case with the Aali people. The only mitigating circumstance there, I can say, is that Kanaka had paid well. Some of them had some savings, and they had been paid at levels that, even if they went to jobs that offered half of what we were paying, they could still make ends meet with their families. So we found many of them in later years. Many of them went to our suppliers, for one thing. You know, this multiplier effect, which is calculated to be over 3 mm-hmm. employees in industries related to Kennecott to 1 at Kennecott. They took on a high proportion of the people who we could not afford to keep. Others went into the quote service industries, into jobs that in many instances paid very little and caused a great deal of hardship. I had a policy always in my office. First of all, I never shut the door of my office because it didn't even suit me to make appointments where I had the whole day sort of cluttered up with one meeting after another. I never operated that way. I kept my door open. If someone wanted to, one of my people wanted to talk to me, they just came to the door and we talked. Which meant that occasionally, you know, people had to wait or one had to shift appointments around and so on, but I never shut the door. And the other thing is that I had a policy of never refusing a phone call. I had calls from Aali people, but they were nearly always expressing concern and not asking for help, but wanting to talk things through. There were very few abusive calls. In fact, just sitting here, I don't really remember any. But that's again is because I made a point of making myself fairly visible out at the operation and also to the media. And they knew darn well what I looked like and what my mm-hmm. thoughts were and what I was going to say. So reflecting back on it all, you know, we were at times talked to by human resource people in Sahaja who were concerned about safety, about, you know, someone with a great deal of resentment taking a pot shot or something like that, suggesting that we take certain measures as far as, you know, not falling into patterns that were easily discernible and therefore made one vulnerable to attack. I can say in all honesty, I and my family never took any precaution of any sort in that regard. You know, we felt that any really serious threats on that regard would have come out already at the time of labor negotiations. Mm-hmm. And there never were any instances of either attack or abuse or threat or anything like that, which spoke pretty highly for the understanding and for the resignation of the people who were seven at that time. In other words, in excess of one-third of Kennecott employees.
Was there any problem out at the plants? Did they...
No. Sabotage or anything like that? No, there wasn't. There were instances of slowdown at the time of labor negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
But what we diagnosed as what we would have said as, really sabotage. And there were some unexplained happenings and breakdowns and so on. But not such that we could pin it down to any one particular. Mm-hmm. Frankly, a lot of the equipment was so worn out anyway.
Hard to tell.
Yeah, pretty hard to tell what the problem was.
Uh-huh.
As I will probably talk about a little more in connection with the labor relations, I think it was fairly clear to the hourly people, to the unionized people, that by and large I sympathized with them,
mm-hmm.
and that I... if anything, in my philosophy, had always been somewhat pro-union, and I think that also helped to defuse any thoughts that it was a total we and they
mm-hmm.
situation. I have always been conscious of being an employee with a certain period of custodianship of the operations, and that the day would come and I would retire and be separated from it, and someone else would do the job perfectly satisfactorily. Anyway, that's...
The other thing that doesn't show is the people that were lost to mining just because there was no incentive to go into it from those years, and that's beginning to be even more apparent now, I think.
Well, how many graduates in mining engineering are there in the United States each year, Lee?
Very few. And mining schools
closing. How many did you say?
I don't know.
How many do they graduate a year?
I don't know the figure.
100 a year nationwide.
Okay.
Isn't that a surprising statistic?
It's awful.
100 mining engineers
right.
a year
mm-hmm.
in the United States.
And you know, not only the engineers, but just think of the high school students who don't even think of it as something to go into.
Absolutely.
Whereas... In previous generations, of course, that would have been the logical thing to do here, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Go to work for Kennecott.
Sure.
But it's not that way.
Yeah. Well, the people who remained, the people who were left, were ones who obviously were good people because
mm-hmm.
they're competent ones who have been let go. But I'm talking of the salaried ranks because in the hourly ranks, seniority had a lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
Who was let go, who wasn't, and led to aging of the workforce. But amongst the salaried people, you know, the best ones remained, and the veterans of hard times, and that's why by the time it came time for me to leave, there was a good crop of people who could
mm-hmm.
pick up the banner, so to speak. Shall we... I had that so well in one of my speeches that I summarized the impact of cost reduction. I'm going to find it again now. But,
well, this wasn't just an empty exercise, obviously.
Is it on now?
Yes.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Okay. The... Yeah, it wasn't an empty exercise because there were important cost reductions achieved as a result of the
program from 1980 through 84 without
major capital investment. At Utah Copper, the... result... was a reduction of costs in real terms of 25%.
From 1980 to 1984. And nominally, about 10%. One has to consider the high rate of inflation that persisted during that period.
So you were reporting to the board these great losses on the one hand, but they were offset by the cost reductions?
Well, they would have been a lot more without the cost reductions, yeah.
Of course, when it comes to, when I say costs, I mean full costs, including depreciation, amortization, the works. If you subtract the byproduct credits for gold, silver, and molybdenum, costs actually rose from 1980 to 1984 because gold and silver prices cratered. At Rinascimento, the results amounted in broad terms to a reduction of costs of 50%. At both properties. At Chino, of course, this was aided by the modernization that took place when the new concentrator and smelter were built.
Was so this in line with your expectations?
Well,
apart from the weather, let's say.
We did what was possible. We would, of course, have preferred to have even more spectacular results, but Utah Copper, the results of the cost reduction program, the capital investment,
certainly saved that operation from long-term shutdown, if not abandonment. At Rinascimento, the same could be said, but at Chino, of course, the effort was considerably aided by the amounts invested up till the time of the labor negotiations of 1986, when there was another major reduction in cost resulting from the revised contracts. Well, let's leave it at that.
What about KRC?
Well, KRC, again,
I'll
have
so
some comments
away
on later.
Okay.
That plant was built with the idea of taking copper from El Teniente,
and once that fell away, it really became a somewhat redundant facility. It was out of the way. I mean, there was very little point in shipping analytes all the way to the southeast and then bringing them back to bringing the cathodes back to the Midwest for marketing. Didn't make much sense. So the full utilization of that plant ceased when
El Teniente was lost, and at the reduced rate of production, it never was a really low-cost refinery again. And despite the manpower reductions which were carried out there, it never did return to
the usefulness and the economies of scale that it enjoyed when its capacity was fully utilized with the products from the operations in South America.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's a lunch break.
Little is the operative word.
Well, it was pretty good lunch. It was fun. So here we are now in the afternoon.
Yeah. You know, I talked a little bit about the context in which the atmosphere in which the
reductions in force and the cost reductions in general occurred in the early 80s. And
just to comment briefly on our own family life at that time, Pam made the
transition to Salt Lake in a very positive and, if you like, adventurous way. And we quickly found that Salt Lake was a surprisingly livable community. It had and has a cultural life which is unusual for a community of this size. If you take the Wasatch Front, including Salt Lake City, you're talking about 1 million people. And I think there's few communities in the United States that have such a diversity of cultural activities ongoing. The Utah Symphony is generally ranked amongst the top 10 in the country. Ballet West is, maybe number 2 or 3, certainly in the country. Largely as a function of the excellent school of dance
that has been a component of the University of Utah for a long time. The Utah Opera started up, or was started up, by Glade Peterson not long before we arrived. Glade, a native of Salt Lake City and a tenor of international stature, had returned from Europe shortly before and got the funding, I think, from the Tanner family to start up an opera company here, and immediately attracted good talent. And it's been a great experience to watch the growth of the opera company in regard to the improvement of performances over the years to its present stature. It's in very good health now, and the direction of Ewers has succeeded.
We might have lost just a speck. Ann Ewers, do you want to spell that?
Ewers.
Okay, and she is also an outstanding artist.
Artist and administrator.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a wonderful job, and it's a pleasure to serve on the opera board at this time with her. Pioneer Memorial Theater puts on some excellent
theater performances, and the cast is usually heavily spiced with talent from the University of Utah and from BYU.
So there's no dearth of cultural life at all. Pam got herself immediately involved in
a host of activities.
She became the champion of the Children's Museum of Utah, which is a very effective educational tool for
children in their formative years from all levels of society. She was the chairman there and the chief fundraiser, and did a heck of a job of making that a viable entity and received wide accolades for it. She served on the board of the Utah Museum of Fine Arts, which is again affiliated with the University of Utah for many years. She's the she's been on the board of the Utah Symphony for
quite some time. She's chairman of the Fine Arts Council of Utah,
and I could reel on and on with the things that she's involved in. She's been a major supporter of Judge Memorial High School, and the chairman of several of their fundraising drives. And she has recently been instrumental in raising the funds to build a chapel up at Snowbird, the predecessor of which got wiped out by an avalanche.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be a great community ecumenical facility, which will be commissioned in short order.
So she's on the board of advisors of the
University of Utah. So I mean, she's really gotten into it and is very widely known and sought after in the community. Our kids during this period, Carl, our oldest son, is still studying engineering at the University of Utah after an interruption of several years during which he was working. Katie, to whom I referred previously, graduated from Duke University and got her
MBA there in short order in the 2 and 3 program, which meant in 5 years she had both her
baccalaureate in economics and also her MBA, and joined the Coca-Cola company in Atlanta, transferred subsequently to Los Angeles, where she's in charge of Coca-Cola office, whose main function is liaison with the entertainment industry. I think it's a pretty good kind of a job.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul went to Judge Memorial High School here and then to
Duke University and graduated from there a couple of years ago and is now studying law at Georgetown University. He's in his second year there. With their involvement in swimming, all of them had long periods of staring at the bottoms of swimming pools and enjoyed the competition. But above all, in the marvelous ski terrain here, they all took full advantage of that and became expert skiers, and Paul has had quite a distinguished racing career here, and believe it or not, there actually was a ski team at Duke University,
which he captained for a couple of years. So,
by and large, Salt Lake has been a very positive experience.
Well, you've also been very much involved involved in community activities as well as
this came, of course, during the very lean years in the early 80s. Time was at an absolute premium,
mm-hmm.
but
with the passage of time, I did get involved with
quite a few things, such as the Holy Cross Hospital organization, and
I've always been very much a fan of Olympics and
winter sports.
Mm-hmm.
When I was
young, I used to read everything I could lay my hands on that had anything to do with mountaineering, mountain climbing, Everest expeditions, and so on. And I've always been very interested in the Olympics movement, and I'll say a little more on that perhaps
towards the end of this discussion. But it's been life here has been good. Salt Lake, the image of Salt Lake has changed a little bit during the time that we've been here. It has tended to be regarded as a town on the edge of a body of saline water in the desert, with very strong religious influence of one persuasion, nothing much else, and it has clearly, by virtue of its cultural activities, religious diversity, has a lot more than that going for it, and I, over the years, have gotten to know and
been involved in many causes, was prominent people in the LDS Church, and have found them to be, you know, good people and good friends, and
no different from the people we've been used to in other communities that we've enjoyed. So with that little homily, I suppose we should pass on to the next subject, if you think that's appropriate.
Yes, I think so.
What I wanted to talk about a little bit was the how the declining copper prices
in the early 80s and the reasons for us drove us to seek out people in the executive and legislative branches in Washington and explain to them our plight and suggest to them possible remedies, or at least some alleviation from the potential extinction that we were facing. So the first thing that that occurred to us in the early 80s was how to bring some relief to this ever-increasing flood of copper from third world countries that was mostly in the ownership of the host country governments, and the financing of which was being aided and abetted by international lending agencies such as the IMF and the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank and its equivalents, its other regional equivalents. But equally importantly, by commercial banks who had been persuaded, or were being persuaded, to lend to these countries at interest rates below commercial rates
on the basis of guarantees from the governments of those countries for what they were worth.
So we said
amongst ourselves, the international lending agencies are a little bit difficult to deal with, because even though the United States was there's a principal contributor to those agencies, when it comes to taking votes, the U.S. is generally outnumbered by blocs that have not very much sympathy with U.S. policies. And this, we observe this happening time and time again, where the United States representatives on these agencies were fairly impotent in relation to the magnitude of the funding that the United States was supplying. And the subject had already come up a few times in Congress, where indignation had been expressed by United States industries that felt that lending by these agencies to foreign competitors in those countries was disadvantaging them. We thought we could make more of an impact, perhaps, by attempting to restrain U.S. and other national commercial banks from making these cheap loans to the country for, well, very often these loans went to the governments for purposes of general alleviation of their straitened financial circumstances, and then those funds were diverted to development projects, natural resource development projects, including copper projects, which were only made to appear to be economic by virtue of this liberal lending. Mm-hmm. And we felt that this was not in the interests either of those banks,
was not in the interests of those countries whose resources were being developed to levels of production that brought about worldwide declines in commodity prices and therefore decreased the revenues mm-hmm. from those resources compared to what could have been achieved had those projects been developed according to need and the appropriate time. And certainly it wasn't going to be a benefit to the U.S. producers like ourselves, who had foreseeably long periods of prices below our achievable cost of production would have to eventually go out of business. So we felt we had a good cause, and the question was who should we go to and who should go? Well, with all the staff reductions that we'd had, we didn't have any people sitting around in their hands waiting to be summoned to a cause like this. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that occurred to me was that I was going to have to play a part, a substantial part in this. And I took as an ally our general counsel, Don DeBrier, who had come on board, I believe, in 1982. Don came to us from, I believe it was Gulf Resources, and immediately impressed us with his keen mind and his tenacity. And we thought these were the kinds of things that were needed for successful advances in Washington. Third member of what became our little team was our Washington representative, David Litvin. Again, a very bright man who had degrees in metallurgical engineering and in law, and knew his way around Washington, was very well known and respected despite his, at the time, fairly youthful years in Washington. So we put together a brief stating our views that commercial banks should be restrained in their lending activities of the type that I have described. And we made our first visit in May of 1983. We decided to begin with the legislature rather than with the executive branch, and in retrospect that turned out to be a very wise decision. And we had to deal with the Senate, the House, and the White House. Naturally, we began with the Senate because there were two strong, respected representatives from the state of Utah, whom I already mentioned, Jay Garn, Senators Jay Garn and Orrin Hatch. They readily understood our arguments, and we suggested to them that an amendment might be drafted that would be attached to an IMF funding bill. Um, to introduce that amendment successfully required quite a few co-sponsors, and we recognized that irrespectively of the number of sponsors, if the amendment came to the appropriate committee and then ultimately to the floor of the Senate, we would have a lot of people right-minded with what it was we were trying to do. Because let's remember this, the mining industry is concentrated in a few western states where the populace and the politicians are pretty au fait with what the nature of the mining industry is and what it means to the national economy. Outside of those states, outside of those few states, knowledge of the mining industry is close to zero, mm-hmm. and there always has been a lot of misunderstanding about the mining industry as being totally irresponsible in environmental matters, and despoiling the nation's heritage, which can never be replaced. I'm not saying anything new there, because I'm not sure whether I've mentioned this before, but De Re Metallica by Georg Bauer, otherwise known as Agricola, written in the 16th century, excellent treatise on all aspects of the mining industry, translated into English by a former president of the United States, Herbert Hoover, and his wife. It contains whole chapters that could be lifted out and applied to today. And Mr. Bauer's laments about the image of the mining industry as being a lousy one at that time were just as apposite then as they evidently as they are today. So we quickly decided that it wasn't just a matter of covering our friendly senators from the West, which would constitute preaching to the choir, and I'm talking now about Republicans and Democrats, they all know the mining industry in the West. We had to go to and far beyond the Mississippi, and in the course of our first visit, we began to lobby some of the senior senators right across the country, and it was amazing to me how receptive these men and women who'd hardly ever heard of the mining industry were once they recognized that someone in a position of authority had come to see them and had taken the trouble to explain their point of view to them. That's one very broad criticism I have of the U.S. mining industry in the past, the reluctance that the leaders of the mining industry have had to go to Washington and lobby themselves rather than just leaving it to their Washington representative. Few of them would have been as competent and experienced as our David Litman was. Washington reps, by and large, get as far as the staffers, and the staffers have their own views, and if they see a way and means of turning something off in the interest of according with their own views, or if they just want to save themselves a time, the matter never does get to the attention of the mm-hmm. corresponding senator or congressman, so it's necessary to go and see the man himself. We always found it was relatively simple to get appointments. We used to make on our lobbying campaigns, we used to make about 12 appointments a day, allowing a half hour at each, scurrying like crazy between them. David and I used to outdistance Don DeBrier on those things. Don DeBrier was pretty fast on the tennis court, but he didn't like to walk fast, so we did a lot.
David and I would arrive fairly breathless at a congressman or senator's office, and then Don would make his appearance 5 minutes later, maybe, and that wasn't all bad because he'd sort of reinforce what we'd been saying. So they heard it twice over. Sometimes towards the end of the day, I would get sympathy from a member of Congress about having had a rough day, and my usual response was, well, it sure beats working. Because I honestly did not find lobbying a difficult chore. I enjoyed meeting the people. I was pleasantly surprised by the level of, I don't want to sound patronizing, but these are all bright people mm-hmm. in Congress. One may not always agree with their views, but one thing I became convinced of, that to get elected to Congress, you have to have quite a lot on the ball. And we found very few people in either the House or the Senate where we thought, well, we spent the time, and he's probably well-meaning, but he didn't really understand what we were saying. They understood in short order.
Hmm, that's good.
Yeah. I wish I could say the same for the executive branch, where mm-hmm. perhaps the reverse is true. So we began our lobbying there in May of 83, and I don't have a record of how many trips we made, but they were numerous. We used to go every couple of weeks, and in the course of that, I guess we must have covered, I would think, two-thirds of the Senate mm-hmm. and maybe one-third of the House. So you can imagine the number of trips and the number of appointments. Mm-hmm. And it was all individual visits to those people. Occasionally we would strike groupings of, who were grouped for some reason or other, and we had access to them. But we found that if you really wanted to get the attention of a member of Congress, you had to be sitting across the table mm-hmm. from him or her and give me a pitch. I can't remember the names, but of the senators from east of the Mississippi, one of the most important meetings was with Senator Hines, John Hines,
Pennsylvania,
who died in a plane crash just mm-hmm. a few years ago, but he was very influential and very very helpful at the time. And from Arkansas, was it? The name's escaping me now, but I might flesh that out a bit when it comes to the point. The people became the principal protagonists of this. In the House, we didn't know where to begin, because the representatives from Utah, Jim Hansen and Howard Nielsen, they were certainly on side with us and very helpful, but if I remember rightly, they weren't quite on the right committees that we needed
enough
to introduce. Well, they were, but they weren't on the appropriate committees. Now, they played a very important part in this, but we felt we had to have a standard bearer.
Mm-hmm.
So the person we singled out in the end, when we really didn't have much hope of success in the House, was Mary Rose Okar, O-A-K-A-R, from Ohio. And she was a feisty, intelligent lady who, rather than viewing our plight in the context of just damage to the U.S. copper industry, she took it up as an employment issue. appropriately. Mm. Loss of jobs due to mine shutting down, and so on. Because, you know, she was pretty much involved in quite a few populist causes, and she took this up as another. And she was invaluable to us in gathering support amongst her colleagues east of the Mississippi. Hmm. And she was instrumental in introducing our amendment in the appropriate House committee.
And you got it amended to the funding bill then?
Well, this was the purpose, but let me just say what the amendment was. The effect of the amendment was to require was to require an evaluation of loans to the governments and government-owned enterprises in foreign countries. And this, what this evaluation would entail was that U.S. commercial banks had to screen foreign mining, processing, or fabricating projects larger than $20 million on the basis of economic viability without regard to direct or indirect government subsidies. And the amendment required U.S. banks to conduct a written economic feasibility evaluation of a pending project proposal for it to be approved by a senior bank official and to be retained on file for review by federal bank officials. And the written evaluation was to include the profit potential of the project, the impact of the project on world markets, the inherent competitive advantages and disadvantages over the project's life, and the effect of the project on the overall long-term economic development of the host country. The evaluation was also to address whether the loan could reasonably be expected to be repaid from project revenues without regard to any government subsidy.
In other words, you were imposing some capitalistic analyses on countries where they wouldn't have done it that way.
Well, it was to be a restraint on the banks, on the commercial banks. And but the important thing there was for Senator Garn, who's chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, to thoroughly understand it and support it. And he took a little bit of selling on it initially, but once he really came on board, he was very, very effective in the Senate. The purpose was, of course, to dry up this burgeoning flood of, over the long term, probably uneconomic copper-producing projects in these third world countries. And I really think, with the benefit of hindsight, that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
did the Mining Congress, did you work at all with the Mining Congress?
Not one little bit. They didn't understand the issue, and they weren't interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Alan Overton, who was running it, was a good friend of mine, but this was a little bit beyond the scope of what he perhaps thought the Mining Congress should be involved in, and we were doing this on our own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, we lobbied in the in the Senate and in the House, we also tried to get the executive branch on side, and I must tell you that with a notable couple of exceptions, we got virtually no support.
Hmm.
And let me explain why. Bill Clark, or Judge Clark, as he was called, was Secretary of the Interior. And I had gotten to know him because I was asked to be a member of a critical materials advisory panel or advisory committee to the Secretary of Interior, which was chaired by an ex services intelligence officer by name of Admiral Bill Mott.